Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our way if we keep on the sunny side of life.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the TXF Export Finance Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Sheriff, CEO of Exile. The topic that we're discussing today is geopolitics, an issue that influences the very fabric of export finance, whether it's the war in Ukraine, the tensions between US and China, or some of the post-COVID socioeconomic challenges that is being faced in various parts of the world, whether it's Africa, Latin America, elsewhere, or the huge migration crisis. All of these things will have a massive impact on what governments are up to and what business is able to do, and ultimately what export finance is able to do and how it can potentially either help certain situations. So I'm here with Rebecca Harding, who is CEO of Rebeccanomics, Gabby Buck of GKB Ventures, and Chris Mittman of Investec and Acre Capital. And I hope you enjoy the discussion. Thanks very much.
Rebecca, I'll come to you first. Maybe you're fresh off the plane from a security conference in Estonia. So perhaps you could just give us a little rundown as to some of the key trends you're seeing, and then perhaps then Chris and Gabby, you can comment on how this is then impacting export finance at large. So Rebecca, firstly, over to you.
So thank you, Dan, and thank you for inviting me. A really quick top line on what's going on around the world and what I think the key flashpoints are for trade finance, export credit agencies across over the next 12 months. I think it's interesting because when I speak to people, the whole geopolitical thing has affected banks immediately. It's affected ECAs immediately. It had an impact on trade. It had an impact on small businesses almost immediately. But what's happened is things have adjusted and started to settle down. So if I look at where the big picture is, we're going to see ongoing sanctions against Russia. The tendency, I think, is for economics, actually, and the tools of trade to be used as weapons of war now. So I think what we're seeing is a very big shift from a geopolitical conflict, which is a traditional conflict like we're seeing over borders and resources, and a very traditional way of fighting as well, a military way of fighting between Russia and Ukraine, towards something that's actually more geoeconomics. And geoeconomic conflict is very different because it's a war that's never declared. It's a war that never ends because it's constantly about primacy between nations rather than about supremacy. And it's something that we never know what the end game is going to be. And I think that leads to, from Russia, Ukraine, the big thing that is a huge uncertainty at the moment, and that's China. In the whole of the export finance market, in the whole of the geopolitical and geoeconomic framework, in the whole of the way in which the economy globally is going to perform, the known unknown at the moment is China. We still don't know exactly how China is going to work with Russia. It'll hide its light, bide its time, and engage with Russia in a way that doesn't necessarily conflict with its objectives towards the United States and keeping its role in supply chains going. But there's a huge risk around all of that. And we don't know how much China's economy is going to grow. We don't know what's going to happen to supply chains, and we don't know what's going to happen to base metals. So all of this creates an uncertainty around the whole trade environment during the year. So there's massive uncertainty, but there's been uncertainty for the last 3 years, and to an extent I believe we're beginning to build uncertainty into our expectations. The big thing now is what happens to inflation, what happens to energy and commodity prices, and of course the other big trend that I know we're going to be talking about during the course of this podcast is sustainability, because the shift towards a more sustainable way of doing things is inevitably going to create inflation. It means reshoring, friendshoring, moving supply chains around, and that's going to be inflationary. And if you look at the way in which central banks are beginning to look at and look at the control of inflation, they're still actually quite hawkish about interest rates, and that will have an effect on trade and export credit agencies. So that's kind of my quick tour de force across the politics and economics of it all. Good luck with that.
Yeah, no, well, thanks. It kind of, you brought out a number of key issues, inflation, ESG, energy security and transition, particularly related to sort of the Russia-Ukraine war. One that kind of could come up as well is sort of China and Chinese debt. Now we've kind of seen a little bit more of what that looks like in places like Sri Lanka, and obviously sort of base metals and rare earth security as well. So, Chris, I'll come to you. Obviously, I mean, I appreciate sort of Investec is predominantly on the African continent, but keeping, I suppose, China as the sort of the key point here, to what extent is it in your mind in terms of the activity that you're seeing, and I suppose in with Russia as well, is the Russia-Ukraine crisis in any way a driver for much of what you're seeing in the market?
So I think, Dan, first of all, to pick up on what Rebecca was talking about, I think the uncertainty is almost relentless. It's almost the new normal. But obviously the biggest one of all, after you've recovered from a pandemic and then a bunch of different stuff, is having a war, a massive war on Europe's doorstep. And the uncertainty about how that could evolve and develop and impact all sorts of things which affect our day-to-day lives. And I think the interest rate rises in particular and inflation are particularly troublesome when it comes to attracting investment into sub-investment grade credits, which are prevalent on the African continent. As investors find other safe havens for their money. And we've seen also that has not been helped by obviously pre-COVID and pre-war, Zambia tipping into a default situation, but more recently Ghana. And it's also not clear there, because it's been so long since we've had a really decent sovereign default scenario anywhere, that the collective industry memory is somewhat fuzzy as to how this might play out, particularly with the presence of Chinese debt in a lot of these countries' external debt stacks. So it's almost like being at university now studying what the potential outcome might be as it plays out live before us. It's not a historic case study, it's a live one. You know, who's going to take the pain? We're seeing African banks, investors taking 57% haircuts on some of their Ghana exposure now, or choosing to preemptively take that step. We're not sure who's going to take the haircuts in Zambia. Is it going to be the bondholders and the ECAs through a Paris Club type arrangement, or are they going to try and push that, as we hear so much at the moment, onto the commercial lenders as well? There's lots of talk of everyone has to be treated the same, equitable treatment, but I think there's a danger there that with that narrative, you know, banks have very long-term memories, and they're the guys who run the 2-3 year campaigns on the ground, bringing deals together and facilitating a project's development. If you think the banks, or the collective thinkers, the banks should take the same haircuts on their commercial loans as part of a restructuring as, say, the ECAs, whose role is fundamentally different to the banks in the market, I think that's quite dangerous. It's quite dangerous for the export finance market as a whole, because once a bank takes a hit, as we know, in a particular market, that bank's memory will remain, it will remember that for some time. So I think there's a whole raft of complications. So you've got the rising interest rates meaning a lot of investors are moving away from sub-investment grade risk. You've also got, I think, a natural concern about Africa generally, and how it's going to be impacted by all these geopolitical events. The common narrative is one, it's going to be negative. It is negative. And there's examples, two of which I've mentioned, which could be pointed to as evidence of that. But there's other narrative, as we saw with the Pangea Risk Acre Capital white paper, which was published last week, that says that actually it's not all bad news, and some economies in Africa are actually doing really quite well at the moment, and there will be and is investor appetite for those markets. But I know, okay. Gabby, you and I touched on this when we spoke recently. I don't know if you wanted to chip in there.
Yeah, just do my job for me, Chris, whatever.
I will, Dan. I'm just trying to help you. Know, it's Monday morning.
Mr. Moderator, Chris, thank you very much for that. Yeah, I mean, I think really that the, I won't repeat everything, but I think what Rebecca said is, I think, very telling. We don't know where the end game is. I think, you know, the war has highlighted the underlying problems that we had in the global economy anyway. I mean, we had problems of inflation, we had problems of low growth, high interest rate, lack of confidence. And here in the UK, we've got our own kind of mix of Brexit and kind of, you know, political risk, which I feel is undermining the economy. I think the issue with China is that is the issue that it's become a global dominant force, and its interjection now with the Russian-Ukraine war, I think, is quite troubling. I think it's, I was listening to a security analyst the other day, and he was asked a question as to what was China's motive about providing support to Russia. And the answer he gave was, this is not about China wanting Russia to win. This was China wanting to see and learn what the global reaction would be to China's action, in particular with what it could be doing as part of its strategy in terms of Taiwan. And so the game here, I think, could just explode against us. And I think, you know, we are in really troubled times. And, you know, let's not forget, Ukraine is so close to us here. This is war in Europe. You know, I had the great fortune of going to Ukraine in the late 70s. This is before Google Maps. So we had no idea as to where Ukraine was in terms of distance. And we actually got there a week or so early. And the reason being, it's shorter to go from London to the west side of Ukraine than it is to go from London to the south of Spain. And the impact that this will have in the West, I think, is much greater than we have factored. And this whole issue about China and the way that China is becoming dominant, I think, you know, China is pulling back from Africa. It doesn't care, or doesn't seem to care, that its relationship with its big borders in terms of Japan, Australia, and the USA is not that strong. It doesn't seem to care, or want to care, to be involved with the Paris or the London Club in terms of any rescheduling. It's just doing its own thing. You know, Dan, you mentioned Sri Lanka. I mean, China just walked away from Sri Lanka. They didn't seem to want to get involved in being a major player in terms of the restructure. But remember, in Sri Lanka, it wasn't the biggest creditor. That was Japan. So I think there's also, overlaying all of this, there's a lot of rhetoric about anti-China. Some of it is true, or has the base of truth, and others are just, I think, the West waking up to the fact that China has been taking a strategic decision on a whole series of different things. And that decision was taken 20, 25 years ago. And we're just waking up now to the implications of that.
Okay, thanks, Gabby. Well, look, I'm going to come to Chris and Gabby in a second, just with a wider question. So I'll give you forewarning as to, you know, well, what as, you know, export finance is can you do about it? You've painted quite a complicated picture. So how do you operate in that environment more practically is will be my follow-up. But before that, Rebecca, I'm just quite interested, you know, having an economist on the line, just, you know, to the extent you can give any sort of forethought in terms of what is going to happen in this inflationary interest rate environment. Because as Gabby points out, much as sort of Ukraine and Russia has kind of compounded that, particularly around sort of food and commodities and in places like Africa, there was a kind of existing inflationary issue that was related to supply chain and COVID. So that, by all accounts, is probably going to be easing now. That sort of supply chain issue, you know, sort of China continues to open up and sort of certain supply chains coming off. You look at, and so I wonder, are you going to sort of be in a situation where there's effectively two inflationary sort of cycles going on at the same time, one in emerging markets and one in sort of places like the US where it might calm down a bit? Just wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, the top line on inflation is that we don't know. I think it's really quite telling that despite the hubris at the beginning of this year, in markets in particular, the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan and the Bank of England have all been quite coy on saying exactly what they think is going to happen to inflation. Now, there are several reasons for that, and I think, somebody who believes that inflation is coming from outside of the monetary policy situation. So it's actually coming from the supply chain blockages and it's coming from cost of shipping, which have come down over the last month or so. But, you know, they're very volatile and a lot will be determined by, you know, how China unlocks and what happens with the continuing war in Ukraine. I mean, Russia's only got to decide to step away from allowing grain to go through, and we start seeing inflation coming back in core food prices or core energy prices. So there's a lot of uncertainty. And as Chris said, uncertainty is the new normal. And that actually has inflationary pressures. Now, there are two other inflationary pressures that I think we need to be aware of. The first is the geopolitical inflation. And everybody talks about geopolitics. I like talking about geoeconomics because I think great power conflict now is turning into a geoeconomic conflict rather than geopolitical one. I think geopolitical one is important. I'm not saying it isn't, but I think this great power conflict between China, how it's playing its game, we're not playing a zero-sum game anymore where one side wins and one side loses. We're playing a game of go. We're playing a game of strategy, as I said, where one side has primacy at any one point in time and the others are less important, but that moves around the whole time. Now, at the moment, what we're seeing is supply chains beginning to shift because we have, through the pandemic and through the supply chain blockages that we've seen, realized that we have some kind of dependency on China, which means that we have to shift things around. And this is where the whole friendshoring, nearshoring, onshoring debate is coming from. We're starting to have to move those things back. And as I said, those things are inflationary in and for themselves, because the things that have been done to optimize efficiency, optimize productivity, optimize effectiveness over the last 30 years are all moving around. That's going to cost money. And so taking stuff back into the United States, bringing stuff back into Europe, it's going to cost money and that's expensive. But then you also have to add in, and I know this is something we haven't really touched on yet, the whole ESG dimension is inflationary as well, because we are taking away our dependency on fossil fuels. We're moving towards a whole new energy infrastructure. China has a huge influence. It controls 85% of the production of lithium, for example. So, and that's ownership of businesses. So why is it stepping out of sort of African infrastructure? Because it's moving into control of the rare earth metals and the companies that drive that rare earth metal supply chain. It's incredibly important in our whole supply chain resilience conversation. So the supply chain issue hasn't gone. It's still there as we transition towards clean tech, renewables, and so on. We are going to have to think about where we get our rare earth metals from. And the big thing that's happened, if you look at the trade data, is that we've seen a big hike in base metal prices. They haven't really come down since the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. They went up exponentially at the beginning of the conflict, and they haven't really come down. So in trade terms, so that's where a lot of our inflation is coming from. And that's something that central bank can't model. So I'm actually, or can't include in monetary policy, I'm actually a little bit of a bear on inflation, I'm afraid, because I think you can see a lot of pressures that are outside of the monetary system, and slowly but surely you're beginning to hear that rhetoric coming in, on the financial pages of newspapers. Oh, maybe we were a bit hubristic about inflation at the beginning of the year, and maybe it isn't quite going away at the rate we thought.
Okay, no, thanks, and I guess sort of putting that on an export finance context as well, I think we've had sort of 15 years of an inflationary forecast when financially modelling of being just stick in 2% and sort of it's sort of fine, and you can't do that anymore. So I guess that's going to have a huge impact. But Gabby, if you can sort of just chime in with sort of my earlier question, you know, we paint what could be a potentially quite frightening dour picture. What, as export finances, can we do about it?
Well, actually, if you speak to the export credit agencies, and I know that you do through your data and your surveys, what's really quite interesting is that notwithstanding the fact of COVID and the impact of war and the large exposure that many ECAs had in Russia, they haven't lost that much money. And so therefore, from an ECA's perspective, their capacity to be counter-cyclical, take new risk, fill the gap that the banks may be creating more of, picking up the point that Chris was saying earlier, the fact that the bond markets may be closed or closing or become too expensive for, a lot of developing markets, is, in my opinion, going to give the export credit agencies, a real opportunity. Let's not forget that the export credit agencies were established in 1919 as part of the Treaty of Versailles, where it was after the First World War. The whole point of the export credit agencies was to foster international trade on the premise that if you trade with another country, you don't go to war. We're at a situation where that original mandate of the export credit agencies, I think, is going to be dusted down and brought to the fore. So I do expect the export credit agencies to have a very prominent period of expanding their base and remit and level of support in the next 5 to 10 years.
But Kevin, just keeping on that for a minute, because obviously that is, putting the challenge very much squarely at the feet of the ECAs themselves, rather than the wider market, say the banks or anything like that. If it is sort of an ECA problem to solve rather than a market problem to solve, what are they going to have to do that's different to what they've done historically?
Well, look, an export credit agency, if you speak to them privately, they will all state that they are there primarily to support their exporters. They have little to no real interest on the buyer side. Whilst they talk about sustainability, they talk about affordability, they talk about the ESIAs and making sure all of that is compliant and secure. In reality, they're there to support their exporters and support GDP growth for the domestic economy. The points that Rebecca were making earlier in terms of, where the West is at in terms of its economy, the ECAs, are going to be charged with doing more to support exporters and to grow. And I fully agree with Rebecca when she was saying that, there's the whole shift of onshoring, friendshoring, and there's going to be a shift in terms of globalization and who the supply chains are going to be with. And that, I think, is going to create opportunities for the export credit agencies to provide the financing and infrastructure as the supply chain shifts from one country to another. So I just think that the export credit agencies, their capacity to do volume has never really been tested. I mean, I'll look to Chris here. I mean, if you look at the totality of, let's take the one that we know the best, take the totality of UK export finance. If you add up all of their country limits, I would guess that in any one year, the total that they do is less than 1/100th of their total limit capacity. So the ability to just do multiple folds of ECA from one ECA alone is already there. So I don't see there being a limitation by the Export Credit Agency. I just think that this is going to be a gap that they will be asked to fill as other forms of financing start to withdraw.
Can I, before sort of Chris comes in, I just wanted just a point of clarification. You kind of mentioned the shifting supply chains as an opportunity for ECA support. Is that sort of shifting from, say, China to, you know, the ECA home market? Is that what that means? Because obviously, if exporters are the, if supporting exporters is the main focus, then, I mean, if the supply chain is shifting from, I don't know, China to Vietnam, like what? I mean, I don't. Is that what you mean, or is it actually sort of bringing things back on shore? Is that what you expect?
Well, I mean, as Rebecca said, well, let's look at a couple of things. One, the trade between China and the USA is about $350 billion per year. And it's a huge anti-inflationary benefit to the USA in terms of the USA benefiting from the low cost items that it imports from China. And as Rebecca was saying, if that's going to shift, that's going to have an inflationary pressure on the US. So I don't think this is going to be a catastrophic change overnight. But I do think that for geopolitical reasons, the USA is looking to look to change its supply chains to Vietnam, to India, to more to go into Mexico. And that will take time for that to be undertaken. And you know, if you're looking at big investments in Vietnam in terms of production facilities and supply chains, that's going to require financing.
Okay. Yeah. So it's more sort of it's that sort of secondary part. It's either sort of for Vietnamese sort of energy or infrastructure to allow them to sort of trade. Is that's where the ECAs come in?
Yeah. I mean, I was listening to a economist at the WTO, and last week, and he was making the interesting point that despite everyone's saying that globalization is dead, in fact, if you look at the figures, globalization, it's just going through the roof. And he would say that global trade in 2022 was $32 trillion. And to put that into context, that was up 10% from 2021. In pre-COVID 2019, that's 25 trillion. So from pre-COVID 25 to last year, 32. And what was it? 2003, it was 7 trillion. All right. So the volumes of global trade has expanded. 60% of that is done under WTO duty-free arrangements. But it's also regional. So ASEAN are trading much more amongst themselves. Europe is trading much more amongst themselves. So there is a shift, but it's not reducing. And I see Rebecca's interested too.
I can't come to you yet, Chris. I can't leave Rebecca hanging on that one.
No. This is, I love arguing with the WTO. I've staked my career against arguing with the WTO. WTO do great work, but let's be absolutely clear on what's going on here. Trade is not globalization. Okay, we cannot just look at trade statistics and say trade is going up and therefore globalization is not dead. Because if you look at the formal definition of what globalization is, it is the free flowing of capital, the free flowing of goods and services, the free flowing of people, and the free flowing, and this is where the conflicts start, the free flowing of ideas and technology across borders. Now, which bits of that are contested? Trade's not contested. People aren't arguing about trade, but they are arguing about finance, and they are arguing about intellectual property and technology, and they are arguing about ideas. And so those are the areas where globalization is under threat, and those aren't measurable in trade statistics. You've also got it, sorry, but you've also got in the last year or the last couple of years, huge amounts, as I've written and I've said, huge amounts of trade-based inflation. If you actually look at the volumes versus the values, you haven't seen the volumes go up as much as you've seen the values. So what we're actually seeing in WTO statistics isn't just an increase in trade play, it's an inflation play. And that's where I start to get worried, because we're presenting globalization as not dead, as actually globalization is creating inflation. And actually we're missing the point, which is my geoeconomics one, which is if we are fighting over ideas and we are decoupling the ideas system and the financial system, those interdependencies, then actually we're weaponizing trade. We're playing a different strategic game, if you like, to the one that we think we're playing. We think we can play, I export more, you export less, I win, you lose. We're not playing that game anymore. We're playing who owns the ideas, who owns the data, who owns the financial flows. And that's very different.
Yeah, I think you're right, Rebecca, and I'm not disputing it. I think on top of all of that, I think there's the realization in the West, and to some extent, particularly in the US, that China has now become a major dominant force, and there is little that the US can do about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which is why I said at the beginning, this is a war that's never declared. It's a war that never ends, and nobody knows what the end game is. In fact, if you look back and we have a conflict, we have a special operation in Russia, Ukraine, nobody has actually declared a military war. The only person that has ever gone anywhere near the use of the W word, the war word, is Donald Trump, saying that trade wars are quick and easy to win.
Mm. But they can also be very circumnavigatedly easy.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what's happening with sanctions against Russia. It's being circumnavigated. And that's back to the ECA play. Who is helping organisations, banks, offshoring, shipping? Who is actually turning a blind eye to a lot of that because they have their vested interest stacked in maintaining all of that trade? And that's where I think the weakness in a sanctions regime comes from, because it is so easy to divert goods into commodities not elsewhere specified, areas not elsewhere specified, put them on bunkers, and so on. So, I mean, that's where we need to start, if you'll pardon the pun, drilling into the data.
Yeah, I hear that the trade volumes to Kazakhstan have gone up 1,000%.
Absolutely.
And that, sorry, that is volumes going into Kazakhstan from everywhere, or
China and Russia in particular.
Okay, yeah, yes. Well, that is I've seen a map before. Chris, bringing us back then, I've left you quiet for a while, but maybe you've got some comments to add here.
Yes, I mean, picking up on what's been said before, first of all, I'm not an economist, I'm just a humble export financier, so I feel unqualified to comment on this other than from a layman's perspective. But it does seem to me that given all the figures we've just been talking about, how trade and the reason for the Versailles Agreement ECAs were set up is if you're trading, you wouldn't possibly go to war again. I think that's what's truly shocked everyone, that economic interests, and that's national as well as flowing through to the populations in the various countries, can so apparently likely be sacrificed on the principles of nationalistic other motivations, it seems quite fantastic to us all sitting here today. And it is a worry. So the trade is part of the problem, it's part of the solution, but it isn't the sticking plaster that everyone thought it was to stop conflicts. So it is quite shocking, and it's leading to the uncertainty that we mentioned before. It's very hard to navigate. To be clear, we're talking about a couple of things. So we're talking about credit, which ultimately ECAs are risk-based entities. If you look at the OECD consensus, the minimum premium rates are all based upon risk. It's a risk-based model they use. And the question is, you know, how are they going to react? We know what the non-ECA markets have done and how they'll view the increased risk as it plays out in the various markets who are looking for credit and financing support. But it's a question of how the ECAs react as well. And you know, if they stay on cover, I mean, I wrote down here, they're a steady hand. I think we've never needed a steady hand more than we do now, certainly in my living memory. We've been through a global financial crisis, we all remember that. And we've been through more recent crises around COVID and other things, but this is big, capital letters, underscore, large font, bold letters. And so I think the question for me might be worth exploring is, what action can the ECAs take, either unilaterally, which they must always, will be national interests come first, but also from a multilateral perspective and the frameworks within which they operate, how can they be adjusted to help the ECAs play the role they can in sustaining trade and investment through this period, however long this period of turmoil lasts? I mean, that's, for me, that's the key question.
Everyone, I have a final question, and it's apologies, it's probably a little bit of a hand grenade, but you know, see how you get on with it. But all of you have mentioned at different points, let's call it Northern Hemisphere values, right? Sort of, I think Gabby, you said earlier, you know, about Kenya, you know, Britain delivers a lecture, China delivers a hospital. I think Chris, you quite eloquently put it in terms of the challenges that climate change and a lack of access to power create in Africa compared to what they create here are very different. And I think Rebecca, you sort of also said similar there. So and obviously one of the things that's come up as well is that a lot of this business is sovereign business, and that's not going to go away. Now, one area of the world where you could say a blind eye was somewhat given to values was in the huge amount of finance that this market did within Russia, not just within the period since 2014, but before that as well. And I'm just here interested to hear your views as to whether there needs to be more consideration as to what sort of large financings, whether they are for good or not for good, what damage they could do in terms of propping up potential authoritarian regimes, and whether we might see a reduction in or a limiting of activity related to that in the future, where certain markets, albeit those that have people in that really need the help of export finance, won't be able to access that now because of what we could call the Russian lesson. I'm just wondering if there's any thoughts on that.
You're right, it's a hand grenade. I'll go first. I'm happy to have my head blown off. So let's go back through a little bit of economic history. I'm not going to go back that far, but look at since 2014, the reduction in trade that Europe, United Kingdom, United States has done with Africa. You can actually see it. And it's been almost completely replaced. In fact, it exceeded by trade with China. Russian trade is really interesting. Over that last, let's say 10 years, over the last 10 years, you actually need to dig in to the data quite significantly to find out where Russia has been trading. But there are two three areas where Russia's influence has increased significantly in trade terms over the African continent, but particularly, I would argue, in some of the North African countries. We've seen an increase in oil, energy, fossil fuel trade between Russia and the continent of Africa. That has happened. And that has been happening for quite a long time because Russia has increasingly been looking to reduce its own dependency on the European Union. It's increasingly been looking to the Middle East and North Africa and China and Eurasia in order to be able to reduce its own dependency. Now, I would argue a lot of that has actually been part and parcel of its preparation for conflict anyway in Europe. And Dan, you know full well that I wrote for you and Jack and I wrote for you a long time ago saying exactly that. So that's number one. Second thing is, after the last invasion of, when Russia annexed Ukraine, let's be careful with the language, when Russia annexed Ukraine, it actually switched its trade policy from focusing on energy to focusing on grain. And as a result, it's become the largest grain exporter. It's overtaken Ukraine, but Ukraine and Russia between them are the largest exporters of grain to Africa as a continent. Now, actually, South Africa produces enough grain, and most of the grain for intra-African trade in grain. There is a huge amount that could be done within that space with internal African trade, but actually, because there is an equal amount coming in from Russia and you've seen a massive increase, that actually makes a huge dependency of Africa as a continent on Russian supply of grain. And that means that it has all sorts of political influence. And alongside that, you've also, and this has been publicised everywhere, you've seen a very big influence of political forces around, you know, the Wagner Group and so on. But you've also seen an increase in the amount of weapon supplies going into Africa as well for funding insurgencies. Now, why is all of that important in context of your question? The reason why is because Russian influence across the whole of Africa has been building while the West has been looking another way. The West has been looking towards its own agenda, has been looking at China, all of these sorts of things, and saying, well, China's increasing its influence in Africa, and we've looked at China, but we haven't looked at Russia. And I think now a lot of what we need to do, partly because of supply chain resilience and because we need to access a lot of the rare metals and fossil fuels even that Africa produces, but also because we are in a strategic competition with China, as well as a you know, having a conflict that isn't a conflict with Russia, if you see what I mean. Because of all of that, we need to be very careful about our relationship in the Northern Hemisphere with Russia, with Africa. It's very important that we think strategically about that now, not just because we are imposing Western values, but also because there's a huge opportunity for the world to do the right thing at this point and actually start to enable Africa to become self-sufficient by working with the African continent free trade area on sustainability, as everything else, digital transformation, all of these types of things are opportunities for Africa if we can find ways of working. Problem is, as Gabby said, China invests vast amounts of money. We haven't invested that. China trades vast amounts with Russia, with Africa. We haven't done that for the last 10 years. So we've actually lost our own opportunity. If I'm talking geopolitically, we've lost our own opportunity. And I think that's a major concern, because it means that we're not able to give Africa the opportunities that perhaps we would otherwise have been able to do. One final thing, we have to be very, very, very careful, particularly as a Brit, I think this, we have to be very careful not to be imposing systems. It has to be something that Africa does in partnership, but that drives itself. It cannot be driven by the West at all, full stop. So, heads gone, blown off.
Gabby?
If the question is about Russia's ability to attract inward investment and finance going forward.
Not so much going forward. It was more that it was able to during a period where maybe lenders turned a blind eye to the situation, and that allowed a regime to support itself. And that's, you know, is that something, you know, export finance
Russia's okay. Russia's making more money today because of the gas prices than it ever has had, even though it's exporting less volume. And it's got the backing of China. So I don't see that the sanctions and the hesitation by banks in terms of supporting Russia is really going to impact the ability of Russia to get hold of the financing in one form or another, unfortunately. It will make it a pariah state for many Western banks. And that's going to, I think, hurt a lot of banks, particularly those in Germany, who hitherto used to do huge amounts of volume of business from German contractors into Russia. But, you know, as Rebecca was saying at the very beginning of this call, you know, the shift of who people will be trading with and the supply lines associated with that, I was just going to change. So it will be business as normal, but with different players.
Interesting to mention, Hermes was Euler Hermes was the most active ECA on deal volume in 2022, which is somewhat surprising, you'd think. I mean, look, I guess the point that I'm driving at is that there has always been the danger that sort of export finance, given the sort of some of the countries in which it's operating, it can have the ability to obviously solidify the position of certain regimes and authoritarian figures, and a lack of a value judgment could run the risk that you're continuing to support certain regimes, whether you want to or not. And I'm just wondering if there's going to be extra barriers in place now in light of the lesson of Russia that maybe make it more difficult to operate in non-democracies. Chris, I think you're trying to say something. You might be on mute.
It is quite confusing. And I think one of the concerns at the outset of the sustainability initiative is that, but wait a minute, we do all this stuff. We do defense, and we do finance in countries which aren't possibly that popular. And we'll just bring attention to ourselves and get called hypocritical if we start talking about how good export finance can be. To which, of course, the answer is, well, do you wish to be the ostrich, or do you wish to acknowledge the fact this is coming? And it's a question of doing more of the good stuff. How we, obviously you've got to work out what you don't want to do. Do you want to do coal or not? The answer was, we're not going to do coal. Well, that was a judgment you made. It seems politically expedient and easy to do. But isn't it easier to try to do more of what is overtly and ostensibly definitionally good? And are we positioned to do that? Yeah, but I think it's like banking any regime strong country is always it's ever been thus. Indonesia with Suharto and, you know, Putin, Russia, and it's you either choose to bank or don't bank the institutions through which those regimes operate. And there's the people who do and the people who don't. And generally someone suffers in the short term but wins in the long term. Those who choose to exclude themselves from those markets. But that's very much down to the individual banks and decisions that they take at the time. But I think the biggest concern that banks have now are sanctions and how to navigate those, and sanctions risk as well for dealing, you know, as finance gets, you know, if you like, politicized, for want of a better word, and as agencies become more profile, will we see some agencies being extensions of government policy absent international sanctions? So it's quite complicated, I think. But the message for me is, like, yes, there's some stuff that's still being done that I wouldn't personally do and my bank wouldn't do. But I think with the opportunity is finding out how to do more of the overtly positive socially and sort of climate impact stuff, no doubt.
But do you have banks been maybe sort of not doing deals that they would have done in the past in countries with a similar
profile in terms of regime as Russia had? Has it now become more difficult to do certain deals in certain markets, maybe in other parts of the world, but where there's an, you know, an authoritarian regime?
All right, as a non-banker, fully independent, I'm probably in a position to be able to answer that, unlike others maybe. I would say that the largest trade finance banks have been pulling out of or putting on hold their arrangements. And I would say, based on what I'm hearing back from the market, and you know, obviously I've just been at a conference on some of this, but what I'm hearing back from the market is that the issue is not necessarily with, let's say the largest trade finance banks or the ECAs. It's actually with smaller national banks that aren't based in sort of NATO countries, if you see what I mean, that aren't. That actually what we're seeing, and this goes to Gabby's point about Russia still being able to get hold of its oil revenues and its gas revenues, reason why is because we're seeing a complete shift across supply chains. We're seeing a complete shift in who's financing this and the location of that finance. We're seeing a complete shift in the way Russian oil is being delivered into Europe. The reason why is because this is all in the public domain. Secondhand tankers are being used, things are being done in bunkers offshore, you know, and Russian oil is being mixed. And the point is, a lot of that can actually happen, almost, to coin a phrase, sub-threshold, sub-sanction, because it's happening in a way that's offshore, and therefore there's a degree of implausible deniability that goes with it, while a bank or even a small business can say, well, actually I've complied with all the anti-money laundering and KYC considerations here. So I think there is a, and The Economist had a great piece on this, you know, a couple of weeks ago. It's not something that's new that I'm saying. It's something that the reason why we are in such difficulties, and this goes right the way back to conversations that we used to have about trade-based money laundering and, you know, trade-based fraud and so on, being able to track all of those things is very, very, very difficult. So back to the question on authoritarianism, if you are going to track all of that data, if you are going to understand the impact of sanctions and make sure they're imposed into deep tier supply chains, you need the technology, you need the information, you need the intelligence to do all of that. That's a digital problem. Then you need to work with security services. Then you need to work with all sorts of agents. You're actually creating almost a restrictive intelligence service or a tracking intelligence service that you know is on the margins of you know, everything you do is a public record, and that then gets very close to where we are and our concerns with authoritarian digital based regimes in places like China. So there's a very, very, very fine margin that we're treading here.
I think I used to describe my career as being pre the financial crisis and post the financial crisis. Pre the financial crisis, with the exceptions of the limitations of sanctions, I had the ability to do anything anywhere. And it was just an amazing career, being able to do any sector, any type of project in any country, irrespective of whether the bank I was working for had any representation or franchise in that country. And irrespective of whether I had, or the bank had a relationship with the buyer or with the supplier. This was a business and an asset class that the bank was very keen to originate, and then it would repackage and distribute these assets. Post the financial crisis, I had to be relevant. I had to be relevant to a particular sector or a particular geography. And that, in my opinion, has, when I speak to other bankers now, has got so minute that, you know, they'll say, I can only do this transaction if it fits into this sector, this geography, dealing with this ECA, and it's in this market, and this market. And, you know, we have to spend an enormous amount of time and energy mapping each of the banks as to what they can and can't do. Must be a nightmare for an exporter who's got a particular transaction and he's trying to work out which bank to go to. And it's just getting worse.
And understand export controls and what they need to do in terms of, yeah, reporting all of the different types of export commodities, products that they have. And again, this is opening up another discussion, but it's going to restrict SMEs as well. It has restricted, it's created the trade finance gap for SMEs. And that goes full circle back to the conversation on the purpose of ECAs. Anywhere in the world, creating that sort of deep tier supply chain into the SMEs across the world is the way that we keep communities running, the way we create jobs, etc., etc. And that's a well-versed conversation, but it is still a very relevant one. And as we move into sustainability, potentially adding to that volume of compliance considerations, that's somewhere where we need to be very concerned as well.
I think the SME problem, Rebecca, is acute. And what's interesting for me anyway, this is not just a problem here in the UK. It's a problem.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Which I thought it was just a UK issue. But then I'm speaking to my counterparts in Germany and they said, no, this is exactly the same here.
Yeah. And it is because of all of these and all of these compliance structures. And again, it comes with this sort of government full circle. Governments are imposing all of these considerations, regionalizing, nationalizing trade and trade finance. They've been doing it since 2014 onwards, 2013 even. It is post-financial crisis when the fines first kicked in for non-compliance. That's been something that's been going on. By creating that sort of very almost protectionist, nationalistic structure within the sanctions and compliance regimes, what they've done is they've actually created a problem for the people and the organisations and the communities that they want to be able to help. So that sort of financial, social, economic contract that a business has with the state, if you like, has you know, I'm getting into deep political theory now, but I mean that's actually something that's broken down, and that's the role of the Export Credit Agency, which is why I say it has a national strategic role, and bringing together all of this around trade into a national security framework is vital.
Thank you very much for listening to today's discussion. A huge thanks to our guests, Rebecca Harding, Rebeconomics, Gabriel Buck of GKB Ventures, and Chris Mittman of Investec and Acre Capital. Remember, for all your export finance needs, please head along to our website, txfnews.com, where you can hear about the latest news and analysis to do with all things export finance, see our rich pool of data and deals data in particular, and find out about our events, the largest of which, the true global meeting of the export finance community, will be taking place in Lisbon this June. Very much hope to see you there. And in the meantime, see you next time. Cheers.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help.